Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the alarming possibility that a hawkish ideologue who sees war as the first, not the last solution, and who desperately wants to bomb North Korea and Iran, will soon be the National Security Advisor in the Trump White House, where John Bolton will be able to indulge his bloodthirsty fantasies with real-world consequences. Jacob Halbrun, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss the expected departure soon of the embattled National Security Advisor General McMaster and Bolton's visit to the Oval Office yesterday, where Bolton was auditioned again after having been turned down for a top job last time because Trump did not like Bolton's moustache. With the resignation of Gary Cohn, who tried to prevent a trade war but was outmaneuvered by a corrupt Secretary of Commerce and an outright crank serving as director of the White House National Trade Council, we will assess how much the bar is being lowered at the White House, given the exit of 43% of the White House's senior staff in just 1 year. Then we'll get an analysis of yesterday's primaries in Texas that saw a huge uptick in Democrats coming to the polls, and speak with an award-winning television news correspondent in Texas, James Moore, the co-author of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Democrats Are Taking a Dangerous Gamble in Texas, and whether fratricide between the Sanders wing and the Clinton wing of the party will stymie the blue wave, given the intervention by the DCCC in a hit job against a liberal Democrat in Houston, which appears to have backfired since Laura Moser made it to the May runoff in the Texas 6th District. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by Rob Ryman, the founder of the Nexus Institute in the Netherlands, whose latest book just out is The Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. We'll assess the growth of far-right populist and fascist parties across Europe and the extent to which Donald Trump has encouraged this illiberal global trend towards authoritarianism. And we'll also discuss what can be done to restore democratic values and reinvigorate democratic movements. And joining us now is Jacob Halbrun, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbrun.
Thanks, Ian.
And, of course, Donald Trump famously said at the departure of Gary Cohn, I believe now the New York Times have done a study, I think he's lost 43% of his senior staff in the White House just in this first year that he's been in office. It's an extraordinary turnover. But Trump said, oh, everybody's just clamoring to get a piece of the Oval Office. Plenty of people want to work for the White House and want to work for Trump. So I guess, is it a question of how low can the bar go? Because the rumor now is that John Bolton may well replace General McMaster as National Security Advisor, and it could happen in the next couple of weeks.
Bolton was in the Oval Office yesterday meeting with President Trump and has been angling for a job since the beginning of the administration. Apparently, he didn't receive it the first time because of his mustache. Trump thought that it looked unmanly. So it will be interesting to see if Bolton shaves his mustache in the next few days or not.
Well, Bolton, of course, would he bring back the neocons? I mean, what?
Bolton is not exactly a neocon. When the Bush administration invaded or prepared to invade Iraq, I met with him as part of an LA Times editorial board delegation, and we met with everyone from Condoleezza Rice to Paul Wolfowitz and Bolton. And Bolton made it clear that he supported knocking out Saddam Hussein. He was interested in regime change, but not in democracy promotion. He is simply a nationalist, a military unilateralist who wants to attack North Korea. He had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on February 28th explaining why, in his view, it's perfectly legal to conduct a preventive war to take out North Korea.
Well, indeed, in the editorial that you mentioned, John Bolton said, how long must America wait before it acts to eliminate this threat? And everybody in the military, I understand, I mean, that would be music to Trump's ear, because apparently every day he slams Mattis and Kelly and McMaster saying, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? And they keep saying there's nothing you can do because everybody in Seoul will die. But apparently it frustrates the hell out of Trump. So with Bolton there, Bolton's not going to say no, is he? He's going to say yes.
Yes, so we could have a trade war followed by a global war.
Well, looks like there again, by the way, is an example of the bar being lowered so much. I mean, we know that when Trump first ran, all of the sort of Republican, the pantheon of Republican national security figures unanimously, I think 50 of them wrote a letter saying no way with Trump. So he started out with pretty slim pickings. But the one person who's behind, or there's two people behind this in this boneheaded trade war that Trump's ignited, one of them is Wilbur Ross, who, by the way, made his fortune out of buying distressed U.S. steel companies and selling them at huge profit, mostly to overseas companies. And the trade rep, Lighthizer, he's legal practice, and him himself represented U.S. steel and aluminum companies. So if that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what it is. But the other guy in this triad of idiocy is Peter Navarro, who is a complete joke and a laughingstock in academia and in policy circles. And here he is behind one of the most fateful decisions Trump's ever made.
I hate to tell you that Navarro hails from California as well.
I've interviewed him a number of times at UC San Diego, right? So
what you're witnessing, Ian, are cranks and ideologues, fanatics, who are taking over an administration headed by the chief crank.
So this is a better fit for him. So what is the story then with the so-called adults in the room? Is it just quite simply that he's the guy with all the marbles? He's the president? This is what happens when the American people make a terrible mistake and elect somebody to the most powerful office in the world. There's nothing you can do? Is that what's going on here?
Well, he still doesn't have control over Mattis and the generals. It won't be that easy to push them into fighting a war that they oppose because they don't want to take the rap for what follows. But it's clear that the wheels are coming off the Trump presidency. As Robert Mueller's investigation that closes in on him, the net is tightening. Trump is going to get increasingly desperate, and he is going to appeal to his base more and more. Really, what we're seeing is a reversion to the Trump of the campaign. And for decades, he has denounced free trade and proclaimed that he could solve these foreign policy problems like North Korea. So we're getting what we deserve for having elected this man.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Halbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. So again, I brought up the conflict of interest with Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and the trade representative, both of whom are involved in the U.S. steel industry, as both as a lawyer and as an investor, and it's hard not to see that they're going to profit from this decision to get into a trade war over tariffs on steel and aluminum. That's just one example of the kleptocratic nature of this regime, as much as we dump on Putin for being a kleptocrat and running a kleptocratic regime. It does seem that more and more the White House is a kleptocratic regime as well. Jared Kushner, of course, shook down the Qatari government for $500 million for his failed investment in this building, 666 Fifth Avenue. They told him to go to hell. And then suddenly, a couple of weeks later, the Saudis blockade. And now we've learned that Kushner and his brother met with MBS, the boy king in Saudi Arabia. And a couple of days later, MBS starts arresting all of these princes like Alawid bin Talal. the multi-billionaire, shakes them down for a whole bunch of money, keeps them imprisoned in a five-star hotel until they turn over their pieces of their fortune. And now we're learning that that money might well have ended up in the Kushner family, and it looks as if they bailed out 666 Fifth Avenue. So this is breathtaking what's going on here in this country.
It's we have an American oligarch in the White House. It's really the decline of American democracy has been greatly accelerated by the Trump presidency. And you see it in Trump's aides, as we're noting, as we began talking about John Bolton. John Bolton is someone that the Senate refused to approve to become UN ambassador during the George W. Bush administration. And Bush appointed him as a recess appointment, but he was never officially confirmed by the Senate. For him to become national security advisor, the most one of the most powerful positions in the American government, responsible for coordinating foreign policy, for ensuring that the State Department, Defense Department, the intelligence agencies are working together, is an extraordinary development.
But in terms of the kleptocracy that I was mentioning and the influence of Netanyahu and MBS, the boy king, cannot be exaggerated in terms of both Jared and Trump himself. And what's scary about Bolton is that he wants to go to war with Iran, and so does Netanyahu, and so does the boy king in Saudi Arabia. They're all desperate to go to war, and the best deal in the world for Netanyahu and MBS would for America to go to war against Iran, and American boys and girls bear the brunt to fight a war at the behest of Netanyahu and MBS. And that's looking like it's more and more likely.
Yeah, the danger is that Trump gets pulled into something that becomes far greater than he ever conceived of originally. We're dealing with someone who only has a hazy notion of what these wars would actually involve. And, you know, it does have the feeling of World War One, where one thing, you know, leads to a concatenation of events. You know, if we went to war in Iran or North Korea, especially North Korea, could draw in Russia and China as well. You could end up with a world war, World War III.
Well, the proxy war that is going on in the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia, so far the Iranian people have been spared. The Syrian people have died in droves. And the Yemeni people are dying in droves. But the intensity of the hatred is so extraordinary. And now Netanyahu was just in the White House talking about going after Iran and how much he appreciated the fact that Donald Trump was going to tear up the Iran agreement. So if you...
Well, we should point out one other thing, Ian, which is that another log that's been thrown on the flames of the Middle East is the Israeli parliament just passed a law allowing the Minister of Interior to revoke the residency rights of any Palestinian in Jerusalem on the basis of a, quote, breach of loyalty, unquote, to Israel. That is also certain to stir up more ire in the Middle East.
Well, you won't find too many Palestinians that are loyal to Israel. I mean, that's pretty ridiculous, isn't it? So,
well, it's just a sign what we're heading towards is potentially an attempt to ethnically cleanse Israel of Palestinians.
Right. Well, but the spark could be that the Israelis are furious that Iran is now on their doorstep in Lebanon, and looks like they've got a land corridor now from Tehran all the way through to Damascus and Beirut, and that the Iranians are training up these Shia militias in Iraq to come and fight in both Syria and Lebanon, and that is a red line for Israel. So there's plenty of reasons for this region, as blood-soaked as it is, to have another explosion, and this is what I fear. The worst person in the world you need in this mix is John Bolton.
Well, Bolton and Trump would give Israel free rein, and we know that Israel would not conduct this war the way it did the last one in Lebanon. It would strike with much greater ruthlessness right from the outset, because the last time they got trapped at the outset and underestimated the difficulties that they would encounter. So yes, you could see a major war in the Middle East that could take down the Jordanian regime as well. I mean, once, if you had the Israelis fighting on two fronts in Syria and in Lebanon, and then there were direct hostilities between Iran and Israel, you have no idea where this could end.
Well, Jacob Halperin, I thank you for joining us here today. We'll have to stay in touch and keep our fingers crossed that even if he shaves his moustache off, somehow Donald Trump will find a reason not to take on John Bolton as his new national security advisor.
Well, my sources say that he is very likely to become national security advisor.
Well, on that cheery note, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halperin, who's a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of yesterday's primaries in Texas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Moore, a business consultant and principal at Big Bend Strategies, who is the author of The Architect, Karl Rove, and The Dream of Absolute Power, and Bush's War for Re-Election. And he's the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent. His latest book is Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush. And he has an article at CNN, Democrats Are Taking a Dangerous Gamble in Texas. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Moore.
It's always good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, Jim. And what was the gamble they took? Obviously, the headlines from the primaries yesterday in Texas were largely favorable for the Democrats. They had a much bigger turnout than usual. So what concerns you about the Democrats, and what's the gamble they're making?
Well, the district that they decided to meddle in, the National Democratic Party, the Congressional Campaign Committee, was the 7th Congressional District in Houston, and that's former President Bush's district when he was in Congress. It's where Ted Cruz lives. A lot of very wealthy people, some of the wealthiest people in America, oil billionaires, live in that district. And the interesting thing was that in the last election, Hillary Clinton got about 9,000 more votes than Donald Trump. So it gave its first indication that it might be soft for Republicans, because the House rep there now has been there since 2000, virtually unchallenged. And so the Democrats got excited, and they fielded some candidates. I think they had 7 running there. But one of them was a woman named Laura Mosier, who had left Texas and gone to Washington to live as a writer and an activist. And she wrote a piece in the Washingtonian where she made fun of Paris, Texas, and how she would rather have dental work without anesthesia than live in Paris, Texas. And I mean, you can commit a lot of sins as a Texan, but one thing you can't do is badmouth the state as an expat. And she did that, but she is also a big Bernie supporter. And she moved home to run for that congressional seat. And when she moved home, the Democratic National Party felt that her Bernie credentials would hurt her in a general election against a Republican. So they started spending money against her and dumping opposition research on her. And this is something that, especially somewhere like Texas, that local folks don't like to see. They like to make their own decisions, have it left to them. And the national party started meddling, and it left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. It should serve as an object lesson for the national party, though, in that she was one of the two people to make it into the runoff. So Ms. Mosher is going to be in a runoff to see if she wins the nomination to run against the Republican in the fall.
And the runoff's in May, and she came in second, Laura Moser, and she's been running against the front runner, who I understand is a corporate lawyer who was opposed by the local unions because of positions that her law firm had taken against unions. So what do you know about her?
Well, that's just about all anybody knows about her, I think. You know, she's been active attorney and relatively conservative. And frankly, I think that that's probably who the National Party wants, is somebody that will attract moderate Republicans in the district and give the Democrats a chance, whether it's someone who survives the purity test, I guess, of being a progressive liberal. And, I mean, it really is a stark choice between these two people, one being a progressive liberal and the other one being more a center-right conservative, though under the imprimatur of the Democratic Party. So I think we're going to see something interesting in the runoff. I don't know that Ms. Moser is going to do well with it, because it's about to get nasty, and I can see the National Party putting up commercials, making her comments about Texas, and this is a parochial place, Ian. Those kinds of comments will hurt you.
And again, I'm speaking with James Moore, who is a business consultant and principal at Big Ben Strategies and the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power and Bush's War for Re-Election. And he's co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent. And his latest book is Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush. And he has an article at CNN, Democrats Are Taking a Dangerous Gamble in Texas. Well, so far, of course, by opposing Laura Moser, the DCCC did her a huge favor. They raised her profile, and she was able to raise a considerable amount of money. But I imagine Lizzie Fletcher, who came in first, will probably be able to raise more money. But this really gets to the heart of the problem that the Democrats have. And if there is to be a blue wave in November, they got to get their act together, and the Bernie people and the Hillary people have just got to get over it and start working together. And I don't understand why the Democrats can't be more strategic and run liberal candidates in blue states where they are going to get elected or reelected, and run, you know, more conservative Democrats in red-leaning states where they got a greater chance. Which, as you just pointed out, the demographics of the 7th District in Texas, in Houston, with all these billionaires, and George H.W. Bush having had that seat, and the guy that's in there now is an arch conservative who I think is unpopular because of a freeway that he built that may have impacted the hurricane and made things worse for the residents. He's also a birther, for God's sake. So I guess the question would be to you, Jim, is do they have to solve this fratricide first? Because until they do, I think this situation in Texas 7th is going to come up all across America.
I think that that's right. I think that the problem for the party is, I refer to it as a purity test, and what they're trying to decide is the party going in the direction of the progressive liberal Bernie wing, or is it going more of the center-left type that Hillary purported to represent? And unless they can resolve that and figure out what they're going to be and where they're going to spend their resources, and more importantly, Ian, is whether they can all come together and sing kumbaya and hold hands is critical, because without enthusiasm and without everybody walking under the same sort of flag, it's going to be difficult to beat even Donald Trump. Now, people are relying tremendously in Texas and beyond that the antipathy toward this president is going to motivate Democrats to vote. But you have to have candidates, and you have to have people that you want to hold public office. You can't just do an anti-vote. It has never historically been sufficient to motivate people to go to the polls. And what the view is in Texas at this time is that Donald Trump is motivating people here and making them get out and vote. And we certainly have a number of people who are running in congressional races for Democrats. We may end up with the first two Latinas in Congress out of this state in its long history as a result of what happened last night. And the turnout, as you mentioned, went up. I mean, early voting was more than double. It was 106% of the previous election. So there are some indications that things are going in the right direction. But unless everybody comes together and says, look, we're all interested in the same thing. Let's find common ground within the party so that we can win these elections. They're still going to have problems, even with a candidate as flawed and as wounded as Donald Trump is. You can't beat them unless you're together. And I don't think this has been resolved. And I think you saw some of that when one of the party's leaders suggested, I think it may have been Tom Perez, who suggested he wouldn't have done in Houston what the DCCC did. Well, you know, party leadership should tell the DCC what to do. It shouldn't let the DCC run around and make its own decisions.
Well, of course, the Beto O'Rourke race against Ted Cruz got most of the attention in yesterday's primary in Texas. And what seems to be lost, even though there were record turnout of Democrats, Cruz still won more than twice as many votes as O'Rourke. And in the state, the Democrats, about a million Democrats voted compared to 1.5 million Republicans. So it's still a heavy lift ahead, is it not?
Yeah, it is a heavy lift. And I've been writing and reporting on Texas politics since 1975 and the past several election cycles, probably since Ann Richards was first defeated by George W. Bush in this state. It has been bad news for Democrats, and there hasn't been much hopeful. And there have been election cycles where there have been virtually no statewide candidates on the ballot for Democrats in Texas because it was a fool's errand. And what Beto O'Rourke has done is to offer some hope. And I've been to a few of his rallies, and I spoke with him about a year and a half ago before he made his decision to run. We talked extensively in El Paso at an event we were both speaking at. And I found that the guy was motivated in the sort of idealistic way that we all think our democracy is supposed to work. And I think he's the real deal. I know he's been to more than 220 of this state's 254 counties. And as has been pointed out, he's outraising Ted Cruz significantly, although it's primary season and the Koch brothers haven't shown up yet for Ted Cruz. And we know they will, and Cruz will have no shortage of money. But the truth is, Beto is going to be able to compete in a state that has technically 19 to 21 media markets, depending on how you parse these cities. So it's an expensive place to campaign. But right now, he's gotten some name recognition. He's given people some hope. But he still only has about a 40% name ID, even with all of that and all of the earned media coverage he's getting. So I don't think Democrats realistically believe that the blue wave is going to originate in Texas. But I do believe that there are some indications that they are rising from the dead and are going to be competitive in some races. And look, I'm not writing off Beto. I have seen these rallies. I've seen the enthusiasm, and I've listened to this guy talk. And, you know, his likability is about the antimatter of Ted Cruz's unlikability. So I think Beto's a long shot, but he's not an impossible shot.
And, of course, Veronica Escobar won the primary, got past the 50% threshold with the 60% of the vote. She'll be running in Beto's seat that he's vacated, right? And then the other Latina, Sylvia Garcia, also won more than 60% of the vote. So those are the two bright lights, right, in terms of Democratic pickups. I think they figured there's like three vulnerable seats. So they've got two, at least with two good candidates running. And the third one, which we've been talking about, which is the 7th District in Houston, that's the one that's already been contentious. And my assumption would be that at the end of the day, it looks as though Lizzie Fletcher would have the leg up, right, if the Laura Moses stuff that the DCCC put out already to damage her, which backfired and helped her with her fundraising and probably got people to vote for her. Nevertheless, the assumption would be that the Republicans will pick up on that, won't they, if she were to be the nominee and run with it.
Yeah, I think absolutely Republicans will pick up on it. I mean, I can already see the commercials that are going to be show her quote about, you know, rather have dental surgery without anesthesia than be in a particular part of Texas. I mean, you're not, those are things that, you know, I hate to say it, but they matter. They resonate with people here, or, you know, this is, as you know, this is one of those states where people have a sense of belonging and pride that is a bit surreal from time to time, and that's going to hurt her. But I think the big question for me and for most political observers of that district is what the DCCC is going to do, if anything, in the runoff. Are they going to put resources behind Winstead, or are they going to put them behind Moser, or are they going to stay the hell out of it and let the people in that district decide? Because if they pick the wrong winner, or they pick a winner, it could be a very bad thing. I mean, these are traditionally the party, the national party, stays out. They're not without a history of occasionally picking somebody they want to win and helping them, but generally they don't do that in a high profile way and say, this is who the national party wants. And they more or less have done that in the 7th district, and it annoys the hell out of people there. All of the candidates who are running there were put out. And in fact, many of them defended Moser and said for the DCCC to shut up and let the 7th decide who they want. And that's what's happened. And I'm going to be curious to see, as I think everybody else will, how exactly this is going to turn out if the DCCC gets involved in the runoff. I hope they don't. It would be a mistake.
Well, James Moore, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate your expertise in the Lone Star State.
My pleasure, Ian, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with James Moore, who's a business consultant and principal at Big Bend Strategies and the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power and Bush's War for Re-Election. He's the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And he's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent. And his latest book is Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush. And he has an article at CNN, Democrats Are Taking a Dangerous Gamble in Texas. We can take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by Rob Ryman, whose latest book just out is The Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Rob Ryman, the founder of the Nexus Institute in the Netherlands and the author of Nobility of Spirit, A Forgotten Ideal. And his latest book, just out, is To Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Ryman. So the book is in two sections, the first of which is the eternal return of fascism. Why do you say eternal? That's a depressing notion.
Yeah, well, of course, it refers to a notion of Nietzsche, who was speaking of the eternal return of everything. But look, I wrote that essay in 2010. Probably I was one of the first to notice that there was a return of fascism all over the West. And I could refer to, you know, great artists who are, in general, know much more than any academic or scientist, Albert Camus and Thomas Mann. And both of them, after the war, explicitly said, don't make the mistake. You know, the war is over, but fascism will not disappear. And why is it that fascism will not disappear? Because both of them understood that fascism is, you know, is an inherent phenomenon of a mass democracy. When a democracy, when in a democracy, the spirit of democracy disappears, which is happening right now, also here in the United States of America, then eventually you'll get the return of fascism. And so, you know, I try to explain why, you know, why it's coming back again. And, you know, that the first thing we have to do is to acknowledge it instead of going on with this alt-right thing of populism or extreme populism, that kind of nonsense, accept the fact the return of fascism is here again. And then at least we can think about strategies how to deal with it.
Well, of course, Thomas Mann warned that if ever fascism could come to America, it will come in the name of freedom.
Yeah, I came forward with that quote because that was the thing he said in 1940 here in Los Angeles, of all places. But 2 years before, when he arrived in America, which was the start of his exile, and eventually he started to live in Pacific Palisades. But when he arrived in America, he started a coast-to-coast town hall lecture entitled The Common Victory of Democracy, in which he explains the following. He said, look, you know, of course, you know, I'm a German. I'm coming from Hitler Germany. Who am I to tell you Americans about the common victory of democracy? But he says, I understand something you probably didn't know. Because I saw the rise of Mr. Hitler in my hometown, Munich. I saw the growth of this fascist movement. And what I notice is that when fascism takes over, when the spirit of democracy disappears, everything disappears. And so one of the mistakes we are making is the thinking that as long as the institutions are there, as long as there is a kind of process of free voting, then we can stop this return of fascism. It's simply not the case. So then he defines democracy. And according to Thomas Mann, in his lecture of 38, he says, look, democracy is that spirit which is based on the idea that is all about the dignity of man, the dignity of every human being. And therefore, he continues, the essence of democracy is that it wants to elevate people so that everybody can live in truth, do justice, create beauty, have compassion, etc. He said, that's the centerpiece of the spirit of democracy. Now, look at our time. Look at our democracy. Is it based on elevating people? Is it based on the idea to make people more free or to have to live in truth? No, of course not. You know, the inequality is growing. This is a culture which is basically focused on dumping down. Our educational system is broke. And being here in California, you have this new religion with the holy trinity of science, technology, and economics. And the demigod is Bill Gates because he incarnates all of free of them. I can tell you, science, technology, and economics will not stop fascism. Worse, it will make the return of fascism even growing much, much faster.
But in just to follow on Thomas Mann's warning there, if ever fascism should come to America, it will come in the name of freedom. It is already happening. The way that the plutocrats in this country are destroying the union movement is under the rubric of freedom of speech. The First Amendment. They're basically saying that workers should not have to join a union if they don't agree with the political ends of that union. And it's inescapable that in social democracies, as you have in Europe, where you have more of a representation of the working class, and in Germany, of course, you have workers on the boards of the major companies. My concern about America is fascism, of course, or authoritarianism is happening here because we have a leader in Donald Trump who's sympathetic to despots. But the other challenge here is a much more fundamental one, I think, and that is whether we are still a democracy or have become a plutocracy.
Well, look, so this is a very simple thing. America is not a democracy. But, you know, let's put these things straight. I wrote my essay on the return of fascists in 2010 because of what's happening in Europe. And what happened recently in Italy is only the last stage of it. Now, this quote of Thomas Mann is based on the fact that fascism can only be there because it's always in need of the propaganda machine. Now, the propaganda machine and all the lies and all the slogans and all the Twitter and everything what comes with it is there because there is no positive idea behind it. Fascism is a kind of, you know, secular religion, a kind of cult, which is only there to serve self-interest. Now, what we know from the 30s, when fascism and Hitler Germany was starting to grow, was that the financial elite and all the other elites, you know, were embracing the guys, Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, etc., because it would serve their interest. So, again, this is an old story. But more important than this is the following. What happened to the critical mind of the people? Why is it that so many, well, first of all, why is it that the political scientists who still refuse to use the F word, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, and that is because, you know, they have to do more research, etc., well, all of them could not see coming Donald Trump. Although it was quite easy to see him coming. Look, we have to understand, you know, what the dynamics of our society are. We have to understand that the spirit of democracy, as Thomas Mann spoke about it and Roosevelt spoke about it, has been long ago. And, you know, and that's the crucial thing. And all the other things are, you know, are part of the phenomenon that we are dealing with, return of fascism. And as a consequence, because then you get always this thing of, yeah, but he's no Hitler. No, of course he's no Hitler. But there were many more fascists than only Hitler, okay? And then the other counterpoint is, yes, but he's not preaching violence. I can tell you that at the very moment you continue to spread hatred and fear and xenophobia and using scapegoats, etc., at a certain moment there will be social explosions. And then, as a friend of mine who comes from the Balkan and who had what to deal with, the wars in the Balkan once said, you know, when the violence is already there, you cannot stop it. Now, we still can stop things at the very moment we start to realize our education is a joke. The whole whole religion of science, technology, and economics will save us, you know, is a dangerous idea. And people have to accept the responsibility and say, look, you know, we have to change things and start with changing in our mind.
And again, we're joined in the studio by Rob Ryman, the founder of the Nexus Institute in the Netherlands and the author of Nobility of Spirit, A Forgotten Ideal. And his latest book just out is To Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. Well, of course, the person who gets most of the credit for being the champion of illiberal regimes around the world is Vladimir Putin. And the people that did well in the Italian elections are big admirers of his. But the way that I see Putin's regime is it's essentially gangsterism and kleptocracy.
Absolutely.
And now, of course, you could argue that Hitler and company were gangsters and kleptocrats, but they at least had, you know, Leni Riefenstahl and the Triumph of the Will, and they had those kind of decorations. Why is it that democratic regimes can't point out the obvious, that all that people like Vladimir Putin offer at the end of the day is criminality and confiscation, kleptocracy? Look at the models. Look at the regime that he installed in Ukraine. Look at the guy in Belarus. Look at what's happening in Russia. So if you don't have rule of law, this is what you have.
But you see, Ian, you're absolutely right. But this is the thing about fascism. This is also one of the reasons why I'm so opposed about speaking about authoritarian populism, which is also a kind of nonsense term coming from the academics. Fascism always comes from inside the society. It is embraced by the society. Hitler, Mussolini and Franco were welcomed by the millions. In March 1938, when Hitler took over Austria, a whole Vienna was, you know, joyful and cheerful and embracing the Führer, etc. The same thing happened here in America. Trump was welcomed by more than 60 million people. They voted for him. They got him into power. And all this whole thing about what is happening right now in the White House is a kind of distraction from the more crucial question, how was it possible that he got into the White House? Now, Fascism returns. This is the statement of Nietzsche, Ortega y Gasset, and many others who experienced that period, when they started to realize our democracy became an empty thing because we are no longer cultivating the moral and spiritual values which makes us free people who live our life in dignity and who are, you know, welcoming everybody and who understands, you know, that was something like the unity of mankind. Now, at the very moment that those spiritual moral values are replaced, for example, in nowadays society about all our commercial values, because it's not longer about to live in truth, to do justice or create beauty. Nobody even knows what beauty is anymore, except, you know, a kind of Hollywood beauty. No, I mean, it's all replaced by productivity, efficiency and materialism. Quality has been replaced by quantity, our holy faith in numbers, numbers, numbers. And again, you know, the faith that science and technology will solve everything. Now, out of this emptiness, out of this void, because that's the one thing human nature cannot deal with this void, grows, you know, that new things have to come in. So what is it that coming in? Entertainment, games, 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 movies, 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 the opioid crisis, a big thing, and of course the embracement of, you know, the false messiah who will redeem society of all evil. Now, again, that is what fascism is. It's a big, big lie. It's one of the biggest lies. The social consequences are enormous, certainly when the virus comes in. But again, it's a situation we created. You cannot put all the blame on Trump or Washington or whatsoever. We created this society. We created a society in which we said to children, you don't have to read books. We told them, you know, just think about, you know, the best job you can get instead of, you know, learn how to be a responsible human being. And we told them that you don't have to think. We told them that it's all about being smart and data. Instead, there is a thing called wisdom. You know, the whole notion of wisdom no longer applies anymore. So again, we all share a responsibility for this terrible phenomenon.
But history tells us that Hitler rose to some extent based upon resentment and the grudge that they were mistreated as a nation, and that there was some truth to that from Versailles.
Absolutely.
And and Putin is playing upon the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the encroachment of NATO eastward and how the West is out to get us and stuff. How did Trump succeed in America? Did he completely manufacture resentment?
Oh, no. Well, no. Look, you know, I mean, I don't have to tell you, listen, about the 1%. I mean, the social inequality in this country is massive. Social injustice is a fact.
Yeah, but then you elect a billionaire?
Oh, because but this is why fascism is a secular religion. People believe him. This is beyond rationality. They wanted to believe in Hitler. They wanted to believe in Mussolini. They believe in... This is why it's all irrational. This is why it's beyond facts and all these things. Listen, and so, listen, he could exploit the fear of people. And they... Listen, you know, look, the political class lost all its authority for many good reasons, the Democrats included, okay? The academic class, you know, imprisoned itself in a kind of ivory tower. Most of it is completely unreadable, or it's a kind of, you know, fashion model stuff, what comes out of it. Most of the media, you know, you're one of the exceptions, but most of the media, Fox is the most famous example, are huge propaganda machines. It has nothing to do with trying to educate people or elevate people or inspiring people or whatsoever. I mean, here in Hollywood, you know, Steven Spielberg is one of the exceptions to the rules that he wants to use, you know, his power as a filmmaker, you know, to educate people at least in some things, at least with the latest movie, The Post, which is a great movie, or Lincoln. But that's our society. So now, can you imagine that the most powerful country in the world can no longer educate its own people? Well, that is exactly is what's happening. And it's not only happening on a level, you know, all over the United States of America, but it includes, again, the so-called top universities, which are doing everything instead of, you know, educating people in the terms of, you know, what a real university should do. So, again, there is this old story already by Dostoevsky in The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, in which he explains people don't want to be free, people want to be happy. And that's the promise that Donald Trump makes them. Will he make them happy? Of course not. Of course not. Listen, but he needs all the propaganda, all the lies, and all these things, you know, to hide the fact that he's only there for himself and his family and for nobody else.
Well, but what is specifically destroying education? And it certainly happened over over a number of decades. At the moment, you've got plutocrats like Betsy DeVos who want to basically, I mean, and the Koch brothers who back her and others, they don't believe in educating the public because they don't believe in the public.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what it comes down to. And they think that you can just use religion as a kind of opiate of the masses. But what's inherent in this conversation, surely, about our lack of education is also how technology, the promise of technology, particularly of the internet and all these devices, are bringing information, which they clearly do. But they also have bombarded us and overwhelmed us with trivia. And that is the great promise of it. But the social consequences, when you see kids looking at their devices, not looking at the people opposite them. The Norman Rockwell idea of people sitting around the family, the whole family sitting around the table of an evening, that's gone. This is where I find it quite pernicious. It's not just a lack of education or a lack of critical thinking, but it's also our lack of social intercourse.
Yeah, and look, you know, a commercial culture is not the kind of culture which is interested in the well-being of people. A commercial culture is interested in making profit. That's all. Nothing more than that. And it creates the kind of, you know, business culture in which everybody is there, you know, not to contribute to make the society a better place to live in, but, you know, to make, again, more profit, more money yourself. So, again, it's this emptiness. There is a long time ago, there was a philosopher in Rome. His name was Cicero. And Cicero said, the essence of education should be, forgive me to quote it in Latin, cultura animi philosophia est, which means in plain English, the cultivation of the human soul is the quest for wisdom. Now, in this small phrase is everything. At the very moment the society gives up the notion that we are beings with a human soul which has to be cultivated, because it's that phenomenon in us which makes us aware of the fact that there is something like truth, that there is something like beauty, that there is something like compassion and justice and all what makes life worthwhile to live. And that to get to know it or to try to incarnate it in your own life, You need the quest for wisdom, and the quest for wisdom includes the fact, you know, that we have to have the world of the arts, because the world of the arts can help us, you know, not to be imprisoned in our own reality. So again, if you have a society in which there are no bookshops anymore, where the whole notion of poetry, music, arts, literature is gone, then again, don't be surprised about the things which are happening. Now, in every society, you have your dark forces, and the dark forces quite often, you know, includes big parts of the elites. Nazi Germany, you know, it was embraced by the professors and by academics and by intellectuals. You know, the power of totalitarianism, the seductive power of, you know, being part of the big power game is always there. Again, you know, we see the same things happening all over the West. So the analysis is our civilization is in a big crisis, in a big, big crisis. And it got distracted by the idea that it's all about economy or being rich or being a celebrity, etc., etc., etc. Now, how to deal with it? Well, you know, everybody can deal with it in its own a capacity of, you know, we can do things in a different way. Yes, we can decide to be responsible. Yes, we can decide, okay, that our life should be a contribution to the common good. Our life should, you know, we can decide, okay, you know, let's ignore all the distractions about what's happening in the White House, and let's make sure that people have a better understanding, you know, what they could and should do with their life. That's written, and you know, and give a lot of positive energy in it. That's what I hope to contribute with my book.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, and of course, when you talk about beauty has always been subjective. But truth has always been objective, but it's no longer objective anymore because we have a situation, and of course this is in another export of Vladimir Putin's, where everything is possible and nothing is true. And we have a situation in this country where there's no longer a consensus about what is true and what is real. And Donald Trump exploits that enormously, and the Fox News have created an alternative universe. So I think the Europeans still have a certain amount of a consensus about what is real. They haven't gone down that path. But just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the second part of your book, since we've talked so much about the first part of your book, The Return of Europa, Her Tears, Deeds, and Dreams. My sense has always been that we could learn a lot from the Europeans for the very fundamental fact that they have social democracy, which we don't have, where people vote for politicians who deliver as stewards of the tax money that they're given, in return for which you get social services. And in this country, we vote for abortion and guns and all kinds of extraneous things. And we've taken our eye totally off the ball in terms of what the fundamental purpose of government is and what these public servants should be doing for us, as opposed to this identity politics and this notion of voting for social issues as opposed to bread and butter issues.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, this used to be the case because social democracy disappeared in Europe, much to my regret. You know, I come from a social democratic family, and so this second story is based on the fact that the idea of Europe is an idea of European humanism, and it's this idea what Thomas Mann talked about of, you know, it's about the cultivating of the idea of the dignity of every human being. Now, With that comes a political structure. The political structure indeed is social democracy. And social democracy in its essence is based on the fact that government is there to protect everything and anybody who is vulnerable. You protect the poor. You protect people who are elderly. You protect people who are sick. You protect people who are unemployed. But you also protect the planet. You protect animals. And you protect culture, because culture is always also vulnerable. Now, and then you have a political structure which wants to keep a civilized society. But for that, again, you need two philosophical moral pillars, which are truth and beauty. And the truth I talk about goes beyond the scientific notion. I'm talking about the metaphysical truth. And the metaphysical truth, which is this idea that we all have an idea of, you know, what it means to be good, what it means to be a loving, caring human being. We know that. And it's a transcendental idea, but we know it, and everybody can know it. And beauty is not subjective. There is a kind of classic beauty which makes it possible that we can still enjoy the music of Mozart, and that we can still read the novels of Jane Austen whatsoever, because there is a kind of eternal life in it. Again, and we have those cultural sources, you know, as the main source to cultivate our own life, to cultivate our own soul, and to cultivate, you know, a civilized society. That's what we should be doing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio, Rob Ryman.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Ryman, who is the founder of the Nexus Institute in the Netherlands and the author of Nobility of Spirit, A Forgotten Ideal. And his latest book just out is To Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.